This is the best of the Adam Gold Show podcast, part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network, brought to you by Capital Financial Advisory Group. Get your total retirement income plan by texting Adam to 21000.
All right, let's talk.
Enjoy the best of today's show. Here's Adam Gold.
Silver, commissioner of the NBA, cannot be happy. If you're Adam Silver and you woke up this morning and you went, we could have had Brooklyn and Philadelphia in the Eastern Conference Finals. Durant, Harden, Kyrie versus Embiid, Curry, and Tobias Harris. We could have had that. Steve Nash, rookie coach, Doc Rivers. We could have had that. The number one and what? The number four media markets in the country? Nope. Milwaukee and Atlanta. Yeah, that's what we got. Milwaukee and Atlanta. And I, in a way, I wish, as a kid growing up in the 70s, watching Sidney Moncrief and Junior Bridgman and Paul Pressey, and I believe Jack Sikma also with the Bucks, or Dominique and Doc Rivers, even a little Kevin Willis with the Atlanta Hawks. I think John Konkak was there. We don't get that. We do get Giannis versus Trey, and that's good. That's fun. That's fun.
Yeah, you got two legit stars.
Yeah, we do. We do have two legit stars. So it's all right. I have a hard time watching Milwaukee play. Atlanta's fun, though. Atlanta's fun. But that's not what Adam Silver won.
Milwaukee can be fun when they're clicking with Middleton and Holiday and Giannis like they were the last couple games.
Yeah, it's about...
But if any one of those guys isn't really performing, then they struggle.
It's a slog. It can be a slog. But Giannis is a freak. So I'm all about watching Giannis. But last night was simply more of the same for the 76ers. They forced the game 7 with a road win Friday night, but they couldn't come through last night at home because they didn't have both of their engines. You know, you can't, planes don't fly with one great engine. I mean, they can fly, but they just don't fly efficiently. You need both of them. And maybe it's because this is what I have always felt, but I think it's fair to hang this in the locker of Ben Simmons. I think that's fair. Stephen A. Smith has already made his decision.
Ben Simmons, an atrocity on the offensive side of the ball. 34.2% free throw shooting for the series. It's the worst by any player in NBA postseason history. The bottom line is Joel Embiid is the real deal, but Ben Simmons, I'm sorry, I hate to say this because he's an ultra talent. He's a jump shot away from being LeBron James as far as I'm concerned, but he has no shot, no confidence whatsoever. He's only great on offense when he's going downhill. You got to trade him. You got to trade Ben Simmons. It's really, really that simple. Him and Joel Embiid, that experiment is over. We've seen enough. Ben Simmons has to be moved.
All right. Isn't that easier said than done? I mean, unless you get the coach who says, yeah, I can fix that.
Had their opportunity to try to do that this year.
Who could they have gotten, Alec? In a Ben Simmons package.
Real big name.
Can't think of it.
Has a robust beard.
Oh, yeah. He's got facial hair. Well, Ben Simmons has a beard.
Yeah, but he's not known for it.
Oh, that's true. It's true. That's true. He doesn't have a logo with the beard. Here's the problem. I mean, you could trade Ben Simmons, but you have to find a team that is willing to take on 4 years and $140+ million on a contract. You have to be willing to accept either bad contracts back, or essentially, well, shouldn't see or. You're going to have to be willing to accept essentially nothing in return. because I firmly believe that the league is paying attention to Ben. And I don't know how anybody would take on Ben Simmons, knowing that he is, like Stephen A. Smith called him an atrocity offensively. I'd make fun of that if it wasn't true. He is a 100% liability on the offensive end of the floor, other than being in transition. That's it. And how much of the playoffs are played in transition? It becomes a half-court game. Ben Simmons is an unwilling offensive player. Unwilling. Forget about incapable, because we don't know if he's incapable. He is unwilling. And that is way more damning than being incapable. The bigger problem for Philadelphia is that the calls are now coming from inside the house. Here's Joel Embiid on the what he felt was the turning point of the game.
I don't know how to say it, but I thought the turning point was just, you know, we had an open shot and, you know, we made one free throw and we missed the other, and then they came down and scored, and we didn't get a good possession on the other end, and Trey came back and he made a three, and then from there down four, and then it's on me. I turn the ball over and try to, you know, make something happen.
I mean, he didn't mention Ben Simmons by name, but if you watch the game, you probably went, wait, did Ben Simmons just pass up what looked to be a wide-open dunk? Yeah, that was Ben Simmons, the first pick in the draft however many years ago. Remember the process? How's the process work? Process working out?
This is not really working out.
No, it has not. It has not worked out. All right, after the game, Doc Rivers, who has to answer questions about Doc Rivers too, by the way. I mean, you don't have to have Ben Simmons on the floor, do you? I mean, maybe you do, but at some point it has to become about who's helping you win, and Ben Simmons was doing the opposite of that. But after the game, Doc Rivers was asked if you can win a title with Ben Simmons.
Yeah, David, I don't know that question or the answer to that right now. So I don't know the answer to that.
That is the answer. The answer must be no. Because if you were really thinking, yeah, I still think we can make this work, you would have said, yes, of course you can. This is Garrett Cole's answer to the, have you used spider tech? When he went on this, I mean, a chef's word salad of nothingness, Doc Rivers, by not answering the question, answered the question. In his mind, no, you can't. And again, I don't know what Philadelphia can do other than really just try to get out from under it. And look, I've never been a fan of the process. The process was always a fraud. Always. Think about the process. All the number one picks, the Nerlens Noels, Markelle Fultz, all these guys that are not there. Actually, Noel might not have been part of the process. That might have been pre-process. I don't even know. Right? Simmons was part of it. Embiid was part of it. They basically tanked for three. Fultz was definitely part of it. They tanked for 3 years to build this championship team. And other than Joel Embiid, who was the most critical part of that team? Seth Curry? Maybe it's Tobias Harris. It might be Tobias Harris. But I don't see Tobias Harris as being a worthy number two if you're trying to win a title. Tobias Harris is a good player. Seth Curry made himself a bunch of money. He's not even a free agent, but I think he made himself a bunch of money. Meanwhile, the Nets on Saturday lost at home to the Bucks. They tried hard to lose, man. The Bucks did try. They tried to give that back. Alec, let me ask you this question. You're my it's like a quiz. So you're Milwaukee. You have a 2-point lead. There's like, I don't know, five, whatever amount of time is left. 3 seconds left. I don't know what the number was on the clock. It wasn't a lot. Sideline out of bounds by the Nets. James Harden's kind of laboring. There is no Kyrie. You know the Nets roster. Who's the one person that can't touch the ball?
Kevin Durant.
Right. So who is the one person that was kind of left to touch the ball?
Kevin Durant.
I would have fired Budenholzer during the game. Because honestly, anybody else can touch the ball. Anybody. Not Kevin Durant. And Kevin Durant got a good look. In fact, you were lucky that he had his toe on the line, so it wasn't a three. You would have lost that game in regulation.
His big-ass foot, as he put it.
Yes. Man, that was just embarrassing defense from Milwaukee. But they got it to overtime, and I think the Nets had nothing left. They were completely out of gas. James Harden was half a player. Kyrie Irving wasn't there. And Kevin Durant I'll just say this. It's a good thing that Durant's legacy was written in blood after Game 5. Right? Remember, we had already determined, even though we made fun of it, because his legacy is his legacy. And it's not over yet. So he doesn't have a legacy at this point. But we had declared the legacy over. Etched in stone. After Game 5, he's still one of the 10 greatest players we've ever seen. He might be the greatest scorer we have ever seen. But he can't do it by himself. It's like two players that can do it by themselves. It's Michael, and there's LeBron. Everybody else needs help. Everybody else needs help. It is amazing, though, that this Nets team did not advance even to the conference finals. And I'm not blaming anybody. It's the nature of sports, man. Injuries matter. Injuries matter a lot. And not enough guys for the Nets, not enough of their supporting cast was able to come through to make it easier on Kevin Durant. By the way, the Suns won Game 1 of the Western Conference Finals, which is really a series of two teams missing major pieces. Kawhi Leonard, they have not declared him out, so maybe he's going to play with some sort of an ACL injury. And Chris Paul, who apparently, according to what I read, was vaccinated in February, but he is still dealing with COVID protocol. So maybe he'll come back for Game 2, which is tomorrow. Don't know. I don't think they're anticipating that, but maybe he'll be around for Game 3. But the Suns won because Devin Booker had a ridiculous game. Wow, what a year for what a playoffs for Devin Booker. All right, real to the other top story. And I will say, we're going to talk about this after we talk to Seth Greenberg. The NCAA took a major loss at the Supreme Court today. It doesn't directly impact athletics, but it is a major loss, and it's the first of many the NCAA is going to take. They were basically arguing that they couldn't, under their rules, they were not allowed to give academic gifts and support to athletes. This is all about academics, like laptops for or paid internships for graduate students. Couldn't do that. Supreme Court went, yeah, you can. As a matter of fact, not only can you, but it's the rule now. They basically told the NCAA by a 9-0 vote that your rule's kind of stupid. So we'll talk about that a little bit later on. There were two great storylines coming into the United States Open this week. Two. Phil Mickelson finishing off a career Grand Slam, or Jon Rahm winning his first major 2 weeks after his COVID withdrawal at Memorial. And we all know that number one didn't happen and number two did. So for that, those of us who are fans of major championship golf or just golf or whatever, we got one of the best possible outcomes, and that is Jon Rahm, clearly world class. I think he might even be number one in the world now. I don't know how the official world golf rankings. I think he was two going into the event, but Jon Rahm came through. Birdies on 17 and 18 to go from 4-under to 6-under, and then just allowed the rest of the event to happen. Rahm started the day at 2-under par, shot a 5 birdie, 1 bogey, 67. It was the round of the day, and he wins his first major championship. I don't think the following is controversial. You're going to hear from Rahm after winning, which I thought, as impressive as his golf was, I thought Rahm in winning was even more impressive in some ways. I don't think the following is controversial. Alec, if you think I'm going too far, by all means, tell me otherwise. Every single player who at one point during the final round had a legitimate chance to think that I could win this fell apart in some way, except for one. And that's the guy who won. Everybody else, name the player you can pinpoint to a place in their round where they went, huh? No thanks. Bryson DeChambeau had the lead on the back nine. And I don't even know who subbed for Bryson DeChambeau on the back nine, where he shot 44, which included a 7 and an 8 on two holes. That's amazing. A 7 and an 8. I actually wondered what his handicap was during the back nine. He looked like us playing. The best moment of the afternoon was his ball winding up next to an open 12-pack of Stella Artois. That was the camera shot of the entire weekend is that. Like, it just doesn't get any...
What is a box of Stella? Is that an immovable obstruction?
It's delicious. We just say, I mean, I don't know how cold it was because it was just sitting there. Although it was somewhat cool in San Diego, like 67 degrees or something in San Diego.
That came right after Bones McKay's amazing report about the guy face down in the fairway.
Do we have that? Because that was on 13.
I tried to email it to myself. I have the audio. I tried to email it to myself. It didn't work. I got to figure something else out.
It was because there was a... Not a streaker, but somebody ran onto the course and hit balls.
Yeah, hit a couple shots.
And then was tackled. It was just absolutely... Bryson on the back nine was just... It was a comedy show.
He almost holed one for an ace at one point and then completely fell apart.
Right, on eight. And he took the lead and had the lead. And then he didn't make par. He didn't make birdie on the par five ninth. And I think that probably unnerved him a little bit. It showed a little bit of a crack in the armor. And he completely fell apart from that point on. Even Louis Oosthuizen, who ended up finishing just one shot out. And this is what bothered a lot of people. Not all falling apart is the same. It doesn't mean that Louis Oosthuizen just cratered. But on the 17th tee, when you are one back, when you're at 5-under, and actually at that, because Rahm is done, when you are one shot back, you know that, I'm not saying 18 is an easy birdie, but it was the easiest hole on the golf course. All you got to do is put yourself in position off the tee on 18, and it's probably the worst score you're going to make if you're Louis. So you know the 18th is a birdie hole. The one thing you can't do is screw up 17. And with the canyon on the left and the rest of the continental United States on the right, there's only one place you can't go. And Louis went there. So if you want to say that he didn't fall apart when he hit the ball in the only place you can't hit it, then I will allow you to do that. I will simply politely disagree. And that even though it was just the one swing, it cost him the golf tournament. It's
a pretty big swing.
Somebody asked me, well, couldn't his caddy have told him? No caddy had to tell him that. He saw the canyon. He's already played 3 rounds competitively in the Open. not to mention the practice rounds, not to mention any time he's ever played the Farmers Insurance Open. That wasn't a surprise. It was, oh, look, there's a canyon there. No, yeah. You got to go right.
Not to mention the fact that he had made some huge par saves in the previous holes to be still mm-hmm. in position to win. And then you get up there and yank one right into the canyon. Unbelievable. I was begging someone all day to make it interesting. And I don't feel like as soon as anyone got close to doing it, they never could get over the hump.
Literally, if you name a player who had a chance to win, Rory McIlroy, Rory McIlroy.
As soon as they mentioned his putting, they talked about his putting for a second. They were like, man, look out if Rory gets the putter going, which is true because Rory's bugaboo so often is that he can't putt.
Thing is, I thought he was putting well. His speed was great.
Yeah, but he didn't make anything.
He was right around, well, he made the one on four, but he was right around the hole. But the thing is that we had a group text going on. You didn't really need, Rory didn't really need to make anything. As long as he didn't screw it up, he was probably going to, like, birdie 9, birdie 13, birdie 18 with two-putt birdies. And he two-putt birdied 13. He blew number 9 with a poor chip. Mm-hmm. I mean, it didn't take a lot. It wasn't going to take a ton. You could have been the most boring golfer of the day, which John Rahm kind of was. Until birdieing 17 and 18 with, 15 to 20 foot putts. Difficult putts, but he made a couple of longer putts, and that was the difference. You didn't have to excite us. All you had to do was not screw it up, and every single one of those players screwed it up. Every one of them. I thought Paul Casey was going to do it. Nope, Paul Casey screwed it up.
Come on.
He did. But he was at 1.3 under with the entire back nine to play.
You thought he was going to do it?
Well, I mean, he was one of those players who could legitimately lay claim to, I have a chance to win this.
Yes.
Colin Morikawa was at 4 under.
Yeah. I knew Paul Casey wasn't going to do it, though.
Right. But, I mean, all of these guys completely fell apart except John Rahm. And he won. Real quick comparison. 2 years ago at the Masters when Tiger won, did Tiger do anything special on the back nine? Nope. Tiger let everybody else screw it up. And they all did, every single one of them. Nobody was offended when we pointed that out. I don't understand why it's different. John Rahm allowed the field to make mistakes around him, and then he made the two putts that he needed to make to win. And if he doesn't make those, maybe he stays and wins, and we're talking about, wow, that was kind of an anticlimactic final round. But John Rahm made two great putts, and he's a very worthy champion. It's very cool for golf. And we are joined on this fine Monday after John Rahm becomes the first Spanish victor of the U.S. Open Golf Championship by the one and only Wes Durham. I don't know why I intro'd you with golf, but I did. I was thinking about golf when I was thinking about you, Wes Durham. How you doing?
Probably because you were hoping that John Rahm would maybe give you some tips on his Instagram account as to how he made those putts at 17 and 18 for birdie to win the United States Open. Or, maybe he'll jump on Cameo and you can pay him a small modicum of money in order to extend a greeting to a friend. Or, maybe he'll flash back for something obscure that happened, low the many years ago, maybe before he even came to Arizona State. And he'll put that on his social media account for you to enjoy at some meaningless time of the year when you just hoped he'd go away.
I love John Rahm. You can't. You're not gonna knock him.
Did I hang enough of that in the closet?
Yes, you did.
Okay, good.
You did a great job.
Thank you.
Would you consider today a good day for the NCAA?
No. I would consider that if name, image, and likeness was going to be the first card pulled from the house of cards that the National Collegiate Athletic Association lives in, today they may have had a floor torn out from under the house. Mm-hmm. How's that?
Yep. This is much worse. Much worse. What happened?
Well, Here's the thing, and I don't know if you saw our show this morning, but we spent a segment, meaningless, of course, because that's what the NCAA's been for 18 months since they knew NIL was coming. You know, Mark Emmert had hoped for the equivalent. He was Lee Iacocca hoping for the federal bailout.
Wow.
And he never got it, and he wasn't going to get it because when he went in front of these congressional hearings, it was amazing to me how name, image, and likeness, once it gets in front of Cory Booker, automatically becomes, well, when are you going to compensate these student athletes for post-career health,
yep,
you know, education, things of that nature? Well, Emmert should have known at that point that there were bigger fish than name, image, and likeness, which if he listened to his constituency and the athletic directors, he would have known what the federal government was going to tell him. But he doesn't listen to his constituency or membership, as he likes to call it. And at the end of the day, the Supreme Court just did their work for him and said, you're in violation of antitrust law.
Yeah.
And they've even, now here's the thing, they've even done him a favor by saying you're in violation of antitrust as it relates to education expenses, right?
Mm-hmm.
They've actually helped him decide to end the organization. Now, if he wants to let them rule again, they will demolish the organization.
Yep.
You can see this one coming. Jay Billis is, I've just been reading Jay's timeline on Twitter. Jay's basically quoted John Kavanaugh as the way, or Brett Kavanaugh, I guess, I'm sorry, as the way this is going to go. And, look, the Board of Governors that extended him, Chancellor Woodson of NC State, I know he's on that. Grant Hill, I know he's on it. I don't know how that goes down, but that's not really the point now. But the idea that the NCAA has any strength right now is negotiable, in my opinion, Adam.
They really don't. They're just trying to maintain. Like, I've been saying this for a long time. I know I've talked about it with you, but they're minimum of 5 years too late to act. This was all avoidable had they simply been more flexible earlier on. As soon as the O'Bannon thing became a court case, they should have been able to read the future. But, and I've been saying this for a long time, and I had these conversations with ADs here, it was all about protecting the revenue today, and it was never about looking forward. Brett Kavanaugh essentially told them that, I don't know how you don't pay players. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know how you get away with not paying players.
Right.
I don't think we'll ever get to the point where the athletes are employees, but I do think that we're going to get right to the edge of that, and we might ultimately have to go to an employee system if college athletics is going to continue to make the money they make.
At least some sort of compensation on post-career expenses.
Uh-huh.
Because, and look, there are a lot of people smarter than me on this. There may be some union labor structure that could be done that way, but the genie is out of the bottle here for the NCAA. And what they told them today, in not so many words, is, you basically exist for a $600 million check a year from your television partner for the Division I Men's National Basketball Championship that then funds your membership. And you can't do that anymore. By the way, think about the ruling today as it relates to the way Division I athletics is going to be impacted. I mean, just think about now where expenses that, you know, the NCAA got away from in the past, now they'll have to be compensating student athletes for. It's pretty staggering when you think about it. And $600 million may not cover it.
And they also, Kavanaugh, in his written decision today, basically called out all of the bogus claims that have been made
by the NCAA.
Of the game. Fans love the fact that it's pure and it's not professional. Like, none of that stuff is true. The only thing they didn't call out today was how The NCAA has hid behind, we'll have to cut opportunities for other sports and women's sports if name, image, and likeness becomes a real thing because there's no relation.
They should have, like, you know, you and I can laugh about it now. When cost of attendance was implemented, remember that? That was a federal deal, cost of attendance, a whole bit. You know, when cost of attendance and the O'Bannon thing went down, they should have been more forward thinking and not, as Pack likes to say, ordering another donut infused subcommittee meeting. Because really all they did was spin the Walter Byers logic of the 50s and 60s into 21st century language, which anybody who works in this day to day, and realistically, my biggest fault with Emmert is I'm sure he's a nice person and a good family man and all that. He's completely and terribly out of touch with what reality is right now in college athletics, in my opinion.
Yeah, but I don't know that he's just a representative of all of them. Like, I love Randy Woodson, but
I do too. But Randy Woodson has to know. He looks at his budget every year for North Carolina State University. Dr. Woodson, who I've never met, by the way, and again, I'm sure is a fine man, and I like a lot of the things he's done. Certainly. For what I know academically about NC State, but more about athletically and what I know, I would say this. How do you sit in that meeting and give that guy an extension when you understand the perils of where you are as college athletics at this level? You know, another thing that's going to spin off from today, Adam, is the separation of Division I or the Power Five. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're just steamrolling to that now. It's just, you know, we're way, you said 5 years, Lord, we may be playing the expanded college football playoff with 12 teams and living in a new world of landscape then in 2024. January of 2024 could be the beginning of the new era in some ways, I guess.
Another thing that I have been wondering when it's going to happen, not if it's going to happen, but when it's going to happen. Let's talk about more fun things, the expanded playoff, because this West Durham is joining us here. Packer and Durham, at least one third of your broadcast day on the ACC network. And of course, don't laugh. Find the lie.
No, true. Go ahead.
It's actually one fourth of your broadcast day, not one.
Getting ready to go on break, by the way, July the 2nd for a couple of weeks, and school takeovers will take place. So
that's fine.
On Friday, July 2nd, we'll do a show and then get 2 weeks off, and that'll be good. We'll get refreshed and see what happens, and then the next time we'll be ready for the kickoff in Charlotte.
So. That's right. Well, I'm going to that for some reason. All right. Well, we'll powwow down there as well. So, we know we're having an expanded college football playoff, and assuming that we don't have any changes to the structure of FBS football, the rules would state that the top six, there are no automatic bids, but the top six conference champions would get automatically placed, and then it would be the next six best teams. Larry Scott, who is now the outgoing commissioner of the Pac-12, thinks that the Pac-12 deserves a spot automatically, whether they're one of the top six or not. And Mike Oresko, basically, who is the commissioner of the American Athletic Conference, called BS on that. And I am so team Oresko here, it's not even funny. But just your thoughts on how all of this is playing out.
Well, first of all, Mike's conference has been given a lot of credit at this table, right? Because they're going to get one of those six bids, correct? I mean,
unless the Sun Belt doesn't.
Well, true. I mean, Mike's going to get one of those, and Larry's got nothing to lose. He's, you know, packing boxes anyway. So say what you want to say. I mean, next time we see Larry Scott, it might be to, you know, who knows? It might be marketing for an insurance company. Right. I'm not sure. I mean, last I checked, he's getting a fairly nice going away present, and Oresko still fighting for, you know, because he knows Cincinnati would have hosted Georgia last year under the new proposed format, right?
Yeah.
So all that comes inside. Larry Scott can basically say what he wants to say, but Mike Oresko is the one who's fighting for his spot at the table and to keep it there. The good news for Mike Oresko is there's a path for his champion now. Okay.
Right.
Now, doesn't mean his champion's going to get in every year. Could be the Sun Belt. You know, a few years ago, we could have rode the boat with PJ Fleck, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, You know, so let's keep that part in there because, in all honesty, Adam, the 5 or 6 is going to be one of those two leagues, and they're going to play first-round game, and they're going to get it at home. Good for them, okay? Yeah. There's no downside to anything anybody's saying. Look, the thing that's going to get interesting in this is what's the number going to be on the yearly payout, right? What's that new rights fee number going to look at? Is it going to be a high M word or is it going to be a low B word? Okay, that's number one. Number two, who gets sacrificed in the bowl carnage? What bowl games get sacrificed in the new world here? And remember when we developed the college football playoff, remember you had those bowls fighting for survival in the CFP, what ultimately became the sugar, the orange, the fiesta, and the peach? Guess what? We're going to do that again. That's how this is all going to be determined. And whoever comes out at the top will end up keeping their game. There'll be some midlines that won't.
Right.
Which ones get sacrificed? I don't know. I think that's an interesting part of this too.
Wes Durham is joining us here on the Adam Gold Show. I know you've talked to a bunch of athletic directors, and you and I have texted back and forth about this. Mm-hmm. I am not a fan of this. I don't think that it's going to achieve anything that they claim it will achieve. I think until Sweeney, Saban, until there are changes at Oklahoma, at Ohio State, we're going to have the same teams in the Final Four with one exception herein.
That's fine.
We're not going to have any of those changes. So all of the things that they're talking about. But I still can't get behind this until somebody explains to me or expresses some concern for what they're going to put athletes through with adding more games to the calendar.
Okay, then remember what we just did today, what the Supreme Court just did today, and how that ball starts rolling, okay? So one leads to the next, and then you start down the line with what does all that ultimately lead to, right?
Mm-hmm.
By the time we get to 24, we could be living in a literal new world of college athletics. And I'm not saying they're going to get paid. I'm not saying, you know, all these things are going to happen. The reality of where college athletics is right now, and in particular football. Now, remember this. The reason the NCAA is in trouble is because they don't control football too. You know? And that's talk about leaving the boat at the dock now. Boy, I'm glad Dick Schultz and Walter Byers didn't hang around to watch that. The idea of where we are here could drastically change. And in my opinion, the 17 games impacts two schools. And Mark said this morning on the air. I agree with him. It's got to get that's the uncomfortable conversation that has to be had on this. That's the absolute uncomfortable conversation that has to be had. Are you comfortable with two teams playing the equivalent of an NFL regular season?
Nobody should be.
And if you are, then we're going to get it done. Why are we at 12 and not 6 or 8, though, Adam? That's easy. This college football work group did not want to set themselves up for more consternation at the end of the day. They just wanted to go ahead, push it all the way out to where you want it. You saw what the success rate was of the event. You also, for the good of the game, wanted to be as inclusive as you could in Power 5 and Division 1, and you've done that by going to 12. If you went 6 or 8, you would still be putting up some walls to certain leagues even before they put the ball on the tee for the first game.
If it was 8, they were still going to be open to lawsuits because if you expanded and create a path for the group of 5, they were going to sue your pants off. That was easy. And this is also better for the SEC or the Big Ten, because they are likely going to get more of the at-large team. So that's why they pushed for it.
Well, and here's the other thing, too. This, when you get this plan in place and this plan is approved, and now given the results today, you have a lot more customers at the table when you want to say, hey, guys, guess what? You know this National Collegiate Athletic Association thing? Well, what if we go over here and start Power Y or whatever we want to call the new thing, right? You're going to have a lot more takers at the table because they're included in the big game. And the big game now is oblong, not round.
Oh yeah, there's we are headed into a whole new world.
Happy, oh, it's not even close.
Happy Thanks. Father's Day to you.
Hey, I heard you and I basically got the same gift from our son.
You got hard seltzer?
I did not get hard seltzer. I got brown water from my
did you?
Newly graduated college student. Yes. Yes.
Very nice.
Right, 22 years of age. Yesterday, he handed me a bottle of my favorite brown water as my Father's Day present. And I went, I am aging quickly, and my son has tremendous taste, so I'm proud of him.
Wow, good for you. Happy Father's Day to you, man.
Thanks.
I'll see you in Charlotte in a few weeks.
Look forward to it. Thanks. Be well, guys.
Michael Kay, longtime voice of the New York Yankees on Yes Network, also the host on the same network, Center Stage, and that's the book, Center Stage, My Most Fascinating Interviews. All right, before we get to some baseball stuff, and I hope you'll allow us to talk baseball, who has been your most fascinating interview?
Well, my favorite one that we put in the book was Larry David, you know, co-creator of Seinfeld. He was a blast. but probably the best one was the Mike Tyson interview.
Uh-huh.
He came out on stage, Adam, and he was crying. He was laughing, happy, sad. At times I thought I was going to get hit. The whole audience was on the edge of their seat. It was like really raw, really visceral. I mean, when you left the studio, you felt, wow, that was unbelievable. And then I found this out 2 weeks ago, Adam, so it's not even in the book. The show airs on Yes. Spike Lee was watching. At the end of the show, he calls up Tyson, and he said, that's a one-man Broadway show. I want to produce it. And that was the start of that, the Broadway run that Tyson had.
Yeah, he actually came to Durham not that long ago. We did a promotional interview with him. He's a fascinating dude. And obviously, he has gone through a ton in life and is still going through a ton. But he really is a fascinating guy. I want to ask you about how do you prepare, or I shouldn't say how do you prepare, because you prepare for interviews like I'm sure we all do, research, trying to come up with questions, but there's no way that a Larry David interview goes as scripted. So how do you deal with that?
Well, yeah, I think the most important thing, like when college kids ask me for advice on an interview, I always just say, listen, you know, I've heard people that have prepared questions, and we have like prepared questions just to like for the skeleton of the show. But if the answer takes you somewhere else, you got to listen and follow up on it. And that's what I do. I'm with a guy like Tyson. I was just trying to keep the car on the road. Otherwise, we'd all end up in a ditch because it could have gone off the rails. But I just let him go, and he was unbelievable. And you know, you've talked to him. He's just talk about a guy who's reinvented himself. Yeah. You know, I don't know if there's two guys, A-Rod and Tyson, have reinvented themselves better in the course of my life. It's unbelievable. They've risen from the dead.
Well, let me ask you about A-Rod again. I mean, I had some planned things I wanted to get to, but you bring up Alex Rodriguez because I think it leads us to other things. A-Rod has been, apart from blaming his cousin for one of his steroid issues, A-Rod's probably been more open than anybody else who's been caught up in that. How much do you think that helped him rehabilitate himself?
I think he had to do it. If he doesn't do that, Adam, I don't know if he comes back, because people want contrition. You know, they want a pound of flesh. When they get the pound of flesh, then they'll root for you and help you get back to the top. So once he essentially came clean, and he's never really given us inside information on how and why, but he realized, you know, he said, I was an idiot, I made mistakes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Once he did that, well, look, this guy sued baseball. He was suing the Yankees. Now you can essentially say he's the broadcast face of the game. ESPN, Fox, it's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I've never seen somebody rebound like this, like Alex. This guy was at rock bottom professionally, and now he's a crossover star. He's on Shark Tank. You know, for 2.5 years he was engaged to J-Lo. It's one of the most fascinating things I've ever seen.
Well, he just puts him on a very long list of people who have been engaged to J-Lo. Mike, I'm sorry. I had
me.
To. See, you're not on the list.
No, I'm not.
Michael Kay, voice of the Yankees from Yes, book is Center Stage, My Most Fascinating Interviews. All right, quick Yankee question. Because you have been from the transition, you know, among the Steinbrenner family. What's changed over the last, say, 15 years about the Yankees?
Well, obviously they're a lot more stable. You know, George Steinbrenner in the last, you know, years of his life, you know, he actually kept Joe Torre as a manager. Mm-hmm. It's hard to fire somebody who's won 4 World Series, but there's just a stability now. And with that stability, I also think it takes away a little bit of the urgency that you have to win a championship every single year, although Hal Steinbrenner certainly wants to. He just doesn't fire people quickly. Because, you know, one of the things I get on my radio show every single day, Adam, is this. Well, if George were alive. Well, he's not alive. But if he was alive, well, Aaron Boone would have been fired 3 weeks ago. He would have been. Brian Cashman might have been fired. So that's the biggest change. I mean, it's just like Hal is very patient, very calm. He doesn't overreact. He's completely the opposite of his dad, except for the fact that he wants to win. But he doesn't think that, you know, instability actually promotes winning.
As somebody who grew up as a Mets fan and still am a Mets fan, I always thought that George Steinbrenner initially was a bad owner, but became a great owner later in his life. How do you react to that?
He definitely had two separate acts. So after he got suspended and the Yankees were rebuilt by Showalter and Gene Michael, mm-hmm. and you know he realized what he had done before, but. Even in that first time around, though, he was the guy who got it about free agency. Mm-hmm. He got stars. He understood that stars put fannies in the seat. He was a showman before he was anything else. He just knew exactly what the crowd wanted. And I don't think the fan base loved him all those years in the 80s, although they had the most wins of any team, because they didn't like, you know, firing Billy all those times. They didn't like firing Dick Houser. They didn't like firing Gene Michael and all that. But then, you know, in the second act, he was beloved. By the end, people were weeping when George Steinbrenner died. And I think that everybody now wants an owner like George Steinbrenner who didn't care as much about the bottom line as he cared about winning. He once said, you've seen the quote, winning is second to breathing. He said, and it's really, really close. So he would lose money for a season in order to get the extra player to win. I don't know if there are many owners like that anymore.
Well, it leads me to this, because modern baseball isn't about that, unfortunately, because the Rays and the Pirates, there's a lot of teams with payrolls that are under $70 million in baseball. Now, the Rays have cracked the code because the Rays are able to still win. But I'm of the mind that if basically every team can afford a payroll of at least 100, maybe 115, 120 million, and they are simply choosing not to. But when a team like the Rays or the A's, when they win using these, you know, cheap methods, what does it do for the overall game?
Well, I think winning is the ultimate deodorant, so I think that helps, and I think that winning creates stars. So you could turn a star into a guy like, you know, Randy Arozarena becomes a star because Tampa Bay was in the World Series. Tyler Glasnow becomes a star. So I think that stars actually are a product of winning. But it's the teams that don't spend a lot of money and don't care because they're still going to make money because of revenue sharing. Mm-hmm. That's what infuriates me. And, you know, you brought up every team should be able to afford $100, $115 million payroll. Well, the owners have always kind of like wanted a cap, and they kind of have a quasi-cap now with the salary threshold. But the only way the players would ever give in on a cap, and I don't think they would totally give in, is if there was a floor. They don't want a floor.
Right.
The Oakland A's don't want to spend $100 million. The Pirates don't want to spend $100 million. So that's why it's so difficult to have labor peace in baseball, because it's not just the players against the owners. It's big market owners against small market owners. So it's like three ways that Rob Manfred has to solve problems, and it's really tough.
I've actually argued that it's really just owner versus owner, and the players are the pawns on the chessboard. Michael Kay, voice of the Yankees, is joining us. All right, the news of the month has been spider tack and spin rate and all of that. And not for a second have I ever believed this was about batter safety. Garrett Cole had an unfortunate couple of weeks, but he's a great pitcher regardless of whether or not he's using something he shouldn't use. So from your perch in the press box, what's your view on spider tack and all of these other things that are going on?
Well, I think that, you know, the you know, sunscreen and rosin, that was actually, you know, brought to the forefront so that pitchers could get a grip. Because if you ever hold a brand-new baseball, it's very slick. They call it a pearl. And even when you put the mud on it, it's still very slick because the mud flakes off. So I think that the origins of this were honorable. But then, you know, everything in life, let's just go a little further. Let's go a little further, and teams start to hire chemists. Really, I'm not even being funny. Teams hire chemists to come up with the next best thing. And then what started out as getting a better grip on a baseball has been weaponized and turned into spin rate. So it's awful. And I don't think that Major League Baseball stopped it because they, you know, they're in moral outrage about it. They stopped it because the game was terrible. Mm-hmm. People couldn't hit. Pitchers were too good. First 2 months of the season, lowest batting average except for 1968, and even lower than that at times. So ever since the threat, and it's starting officially tonight, but ever since the threat of the crackdown, I think the overall batting average of Major League Baseball teams have gone up 10 points. So there's got to be some kind of correlation.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question there is correlation. I hope we do get back to – I don't need you know, small ball. I don't need that. I just need more balls in play and more fun on the field, because it's still – as growing up a baseball fan, first and foremost, it's still an amazing sport, and we just need to let the athletes play to their abilities. Michael Kay, the book is called Center Stage, My Most Fascinating Interviews. Good luck with the book. Seth Greenberg, who joined us earlier, says he's going to take you up on coming to the stadium. But do you really want Seth in the booth with you?
See, I think he misunderstood. I said I'd get him tickets. I don't want him anywhere near me. Come on.
Okay. Yeah, I can't blame you one bit. Michael Kay, I appreciate your time. Well, hopefully we can do it again.
All right. That sounds great. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the best of the Adam Gold Show podcast. Part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network. Brought to you by Capital Financial Advisory Group. Get your total retirement income plan by texting Adam to 21000. Don't forget, this podcast drops every weekday at 3 p.m. Or you can find it at WRALSportsFan.com, the WRAL Sports Fan app, or you can subscribe for free at the iTunes and Google Play stores.